main concern right now is to try to get the infrastructure up the mountain to be able to clear some of these roadways so that we can essentially get, you know, the people that live up there back to their houses and the people that are stuck up there back down.
That's Ramon Duran. He's with the California Highway Patrol. He was speaking last Friday. Emergency crews are still trying to free Californians who have been trapped by all of the snowfall. The San Bernardino Mountains have been inundated with snow. Some parts of the mountains are seeing as much as 10 feet. It's piling up on rooftops, threatening the collapse of some homes. Some people can't even get out their front doors. Trees are down. Roads are thick with snow. Power is out for some people. Joining us with his story is Jamal Javanji. He lives in Crestline. That's a mountain community near Lake Arrowhead. And he and his wife had to flee their home on foot after days without power. Jamal, welcome to Press Play. That sounds incredible. How did you do that?
Well, it was an ordeal that unlike anything I've ever experienced. But, you know, we get snow up here. You know, it's not uncommon to get snow in the mountain community. It's one of the reasons we chose to live here is, you know, you get all the seasons. And, you know, the snow started falling a couple weeks ago on Wednesday. And then there was the winter storm warning from a Wednesday to Saturday. And we probably got 2 to 3 feet during that time frame. And then we got a little bit of a break on Sunday, but even then, you know, the snow, the roads weren't plowed very well. You know, we were not able to drive. The cars were pretty much covered at that point. Roads were covered. So my wife and I had to walk, you know, just to get to the grocery store, had to walk about a mile and a half to get to the grocery store. And believe it or not, even though that was several feet of snow, it was still manageable. But then there was another system that came in last Tuesday. They were only expecting in our area, they said, you know, between 5 to 10 inches, but we ended up getting another several feet of snow that night. And that's when we lost power on Tuesday night. And where we live in the mountains, when we lose power, we lose internet. And then we don't get cell service where we live. It's a little bit remote. So we lose cell coverage because we use cell phones on the Wi-Fi to make calls. So we literally were without communication starting from Tuesday night.
Okay, so here is your home, and I guess your cars are buried in snow, right?
Absolutely. So when we come out on Wednesday, you can't even see the cars. Our home sits down a little bit, so you have to walk upstairs to get to the roadway and the driveway. And when we walked up the stairs, You couldn't see the cars at all. They were completely buried over the roof. We walked a little bit thinking that we were going to try to go into town to get cell service because, again, we were still without power. And then we heard that the grocery store where we were going to go had completely collapsed. So the main grocery store for the town, Crestline Goodwin's, overnight, that night on Tuesday night when we got this several feet of snow, the roof couldn't handle it just completely. And this is a massive grocery store, so not a small store, and it just completely collapsed. So
We
knew we were going to have to get out of there. We weren't really sure how we could communicate with anybody because, you know, again, no cell service, no power. So we decided the trees were starting to break, and that's the concerning thing. Where we live, there's a lot of trees. It's a forested area, and trees were breaking, taking down power lines, and, you know, so it wasn't safe to even be standing outside. So we went back to our home and waited out the evening. But then about 5 a.m. on Thursday, we heard a huge crash, and then a tree had fallen on our driveway on top of the car, the submerged cars, blocking our way to get out of the house. So what we did is we just grabbed a couple of carry-on suitcases that we have for traveling and just filled everything we could in the suitcases and then a couple of backpacks. And then we made our way out and had to climb over this fallen tree, you know, and climb down into the road that had not been plowed. And we made our way on foot with these carry-on luggage, dragging these carry-on luggages through, you know, several feet of snow, you know, until we had to hike for about 3 miles to get to a friend's house for safety. And there was a friend of ours who had power and internet service, so we could get there and then make arrangements to try to get our way over to the next town, over to Lake Arrowhead, where we have family, where we can stay. So we had to end up digging her car out.
So how was that hike, that 3-mile hike, you're dragging your belongings. Are you wearing hiking boots, snowshoes? How are you getting through all that snow?
Just to give you a little indication, there's a stop sign at the end of our road, and the snow is literally up to the sign itself, up to the actual stop sign. And So we're dragging these suitcases in several feet of snow. It was really challenging. We have, you know, just regular hiking boots and coats on, but it was not easy because the roads haven't been plowed. So literally people are walking, or we're trying to walk in tracks that cars have driven in. But, you know, outside of that, you know, if you step off those tracks, I mean, you can literally be chest high in snow. But we did make it over to our friend's house, and they were able to get us part way to a little town called Blue Jay. And then we had to hike the rest of the way to a location where a neighbor who had a 4-wheel drive could pick us up and get us to our family's home in Lake Arrowhead.
Well, you're lucky you're in good enough shape to have done all that. And I guess you're fairly young, but I can imagine some people who are older or have tiny little kids or maybe are not as healthy couldn't do what you just did.
I mean, we were probably on the road, you know, with all the shoveling to get our friend's car undug and the hiking. I mean, it was probably a 10-hour day. We know people in the town that they just do not have the ability. They're elderly. They don't have the ability to hike like that to get out of their homes. Most people are snowed in. So it's a challenge. It's a real challenge because a lot of the roadways here still are not plowed.
Well, that's a little surprising because the governor declared a state of emergency and the National Guard is there, right? So what's happening?
Yeah, we saw helicopters from the National Guard. We've heard reports of them setting up. What I've heard is that a lot of the equipment is waiting to get delivered here because they don't have chains for the vehicles. So they're still waiting on these chains to get here. And that's going to take a while. There's so many little small roads off of our neighborhood that haven't been plowed at all. I mean, so you're hiking. There's 91 inches of snow that fell in the Crestline area. Driving is out of the question. So people are reduced to being on foot. When you're trying to walk in 91 inches of snow, it's really difficult. So I'm not sure where the plows are, but there's a huge need for them. We need, you know, and there's just a lot of side streets. There's a lot of just elderly folks, a lot of people who just can't get out of their house that need to get rescued.
Wow. How many people do you think, I mean, if you could estimate your neighbors and the community that you know of, how many people do you think still need help?
Oh, thousands, tens of thousands of, you know, it's hard to imagine, I mean, for the area, the wider area, but in Crestline alone, there has to be thousands of people that are just stranded right now. You know, there's a Facebook group for the community, and I monitor that just to see what's going on with our neighbors. And there are just people, you know, begging for help, asking for rides, for assistance getting out of their home. There's folks who are running out of medication. You know, they just can't get down the mountain. If they get down the mountain, they've had family members who went down the mountain to pick up supplies. Medication, but then they're not being allowed to come back up the mountain. So that's a challenge. Once you leave the mountain, you can't get back. The biggest problem is that the main grocery store for the town of Crestline, that's the grocery store that collapsed. Mm-hmm. So there's no real central food, you know, store for the town. So they have to go to, there's another town called Blue Jay, and the main grocery store there was compromised because of all the snow. I think they had their roof was compromised and they had a gas leak. And so they had to shut their doors. And so there's really the only grocery store is in Lake Arrowhead, and that services this entire community. And in order to get to Lake Arrowhead, you have to have vehicles, and because it's a 15-minute drive from Crestline, and people can't, you know, the cars are buried. And then the roads that do get plowed, one of the main problems is once they plow the road, you have a berm of snow, probably 8 to 10 feet tall, that's right. Just simply not manageable for someone to dig out of that. So people are literally trapped in their homes no ability to get food or medicine. And that's a challenge.
Yeah, for sure. Any idea when you'll be able to get back to your house?
You know, right now we don't have any vehicles because, again, they're stuck in the
driveway
with us. they're trapped, they're under snow, there's a tree there, tree down on the driveway, on top of the cars. So we're just waiting until they plow the road. Right now, our knowledge, they still have not plowed the road. The power is still out in our home. So we can't get back until they plow the road and we get the power back on.
Wow. And that was Thursday. So you left on Thursday and they still haven't plowed the road. Wow.
Right.
Well, you take care of yourself and I wish you all the luck in the world and hope you get home soon and you're safe.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you covering the story.
That's Jamal Javanji. He's a resident of the mountain community of Crestline, which is completely snowed under. And major roadways in that area are now plowed, but as Jamal said, they have created huge berms that have trapped thousands of residents. The San Bernardino Sun reported last week that much of the county's snow removal equipment has not been deployed because of a lack of snow tire chains, and that a county official admitted they would do things differently next time. We reached out to the Public Works Department there about this. They did not return our calls before this interview aired. Coming up, why the Supreme Court may not decide the biggest case of the term. Our legal is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Late last year, the Supreme Court heard nearly 3 hours of oral arguments in an election law case from North Carolina. And depending on how the court rules, it could give state lawmakers unprecedented power over how elections are run. It could prevent state judges from intervening if state lawmakers pass something that is unconstitutional. It's the biggest case of this year's term, and it could have colossal implications for the next presidential election. But, and there's always a but, the Supreme Court now may throw it out entirely. They asked for briefs late last week asking why they should still have jurisdiction now that the state Supreme Court in North Carolina plans to rehear the original case next week. We're going to talk about why with Jessica Levinson, our legal here on Press Play. She is also a professor at Loyola Law School. Hello.
Hello.
All right. So the big legal issue at play here is called the independent state legislature theory. And it sounds a little academic, but it's actually a real life theory that is being tested right now. Remind us what this is.
Well, I think it is a little academic. And frankly, I don't think that this should be a theory that gains any sort of widespread attention. And I actually don't think this ever should have gotten to the Supreme Court. The theory basically is that in the Constitution, when it says that state legislatures are in charge of the time, place, and manner of federal elections, then that word legislatures, it just means state lawmakers. It doesn't mean state court judges. It doesn't mean the governor. It doesn't mean the state secretary of state. And so that would give state lawmakers basically unfettered discretion to make decisions about federal elections. And it's not just redistricting. I mean, it's also voter ID laws, it's polling places, it's the date and time of primary elections. It would really give state lawmakers so much authority.
And not only over state elections, but also federal elections like a presidential election.
Well, that's exactly right. So there's another part of the Constitution that talks about, of course, the Electoral College and state legislatures sending slates of electors to the Electoral College. And so if it truly is just that state legislatures have that power, then all of a sudden we have to question whether or not state legislatures could even undermine the will of the state. And regardless of who the people in that state voted for, if the state legislatures could just send their own slate of electors. Now, I do have to say, Madeline, that is a really extreme reading of this theory. And during oral arguments in December, when the court heard this case, it didn't seem like there were five votes for that more extreme version that would affect presidential elections.
But did they seem amenable to some version of this?
They did. I mean, that's the thing that was strange. As you said, 3 hours of oral arguments. I remember it back in December. You and I talked about it. And we know that there are four votes on the court to at least discuss the issue, to at least probably give the issue, this theory, some weight. But what I'm not sure, and I don't know if anybody's sure, is whether or not there's five votes to say yes, and we're adopting that theory. Now, of course, as we're talking about, the Supreme Court might just get rid of this case, and then we won't know, at least for a while, whether there ever would have been a fifth vote that subscribes to this particular theory.
Okay, so just a recap. This is in North Carolina. The state legislature wanted to do some gerrymandering, and the state Supreme Court in North Carolina said, no, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional, and the legislators appealed to the Supreme Court. Now, that court has changed hands, and instead of leaning Democratic, it now leans Republican, and they've decided to reconsider their original ruling?
They have. It's pretty extraordinary, but exactly as you said, the court used to lean in favor of Democrats, the state Supreme Court, now it leans in favor of Republicans, and they've decided to hear two big election law cases. One deals with voting rights, and the other is the case we've been talking about that deals with the state lawmakers redrawing federal district lines. Of course, the state Supreme Court said that the GOP lawmakers drew those lines in such an egregious partisan gerrymander that they actually violated the state constitution. That's the case that went up to the Supreme Court. But because they're rehearing it, there might not be a final judgment that the Supreme Court is reviewing. And when the federal Supreme Court reviews a decision from a state Supreme Court, what we need is a final decision. Mm. But because they're rehearing the case, it's not clear if there is, in fact, a final decision.
But are they seriously just rehearing the case because it's sort of a partisan issue that there are just more Republicans now on that state Supreme Court? Is that really the only reason?
Well, what I'll say is it's very strange to decide to rehear a case. They've decided to rehear only two cases that deal with elections and have really broad implication for the balance of political power in North Carolina. So is that really the only reason? I mean, the state GOP said to the Supreme Court, we think you should reconsider. They agreed. Hmm. You know, it's for everybody else to determine why. But I will say the legal issues didn't change here.
Right. Okay. So the court last week said, we'll wait for your final decision on this before we decide this case.
So the Supreme Court last week said, hey, maybe you should give us some more briefing on this. Basically, what's going on? Do we still have a final order, a final decision that we're reviewing? And they've asked for additional supplemental briefing. I think, frankly, that this is an off-ramp for the U.S. Supreme Court. I think during oral arguments, they listened to each other. They listened to the colleagues. And I think they want to get rid of this case for now. And this might just be the gift that they're looking for, because they might say, look, we can't, we don't have jurisdiction. There's not a final decision to review. So we've seen the court do this before in other big election cases where they think they want to hear the case. It comes before the court. There's oral arguments. It doesn't maybe go exactly as either side wants. And then they'll say something like, oh, just kidding. There isn't standing, or it's moot now. And they basically kick the can down the road.
So what does this mean for North Carolina, though? So if this newly constructed state Supreme Court rules in favor of the Republican legislature, what could that mean for this state, the state that is pretty pro-Trump? It went for Trump in the last two presidential elections.
So the case itself, again, deals with the congressional district lines, and it would probably mean that the congressional district lines drawn by the GOP lawmakers could stand, because the state Supreme Court would presumably be saying, oh, actually, those lines that you drew, they aren't such an egregious partisan gerrymander that they violate the state constitution, and so they can stand. Obviously, that would be helpful for Republican congressional candidates moving forward. And it's just no coincidence that we're talking about these big election cases and these big redistricting cases when it comes to some states that tend to either be purple or go kind of up and back throughout the years.
So is there any other case making its way to the Supreme Court that could test this independent state legislature theory?
Well, that's a great question, right? Just because this particular case might end doesn't mean that this theory dies. And so if the court does in fact decide to say, you know what, sorry, just kidding, we're not hearing this case, then I do expect that there would be another challenge. Again, we know there's four votes to say that we want to explore this theory. The question is, if there actually are still four votes after those four conservatives heard their colleagues and heard maybe that there isn't a fifth colleague to say, yes, we want to go ahead and adhere to this doctrine. So they might just want to let it go for a few years as well.
Jessica Levinson, she is our regular legal here on Press Play and a professor at Loyola Law School. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, The Elephant Whispers, nominated for an Oscar for Best Short Documentary. The movie follows a couple that takes care of orphaned baby elephants, and it tells a larger story of environmental destruction.
The elephant is very intelligent and emotional and a social being. So it was a really good place to start because I think humans can relate to elephants because elephants share many human traits.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the remote forests of South India, there's a community of people whose lives revolve around caring for endangered Asian elephants. That's where we meet Bhuman and Belly, a couple who have adopted an abandoned baby elephant named Raghu.
Who is it? Who do you want? Oh, my dear child, who is this? Who is the best elephant? Is it you? Is it you? Who is the best elephant?
Watching this couple care for Raghu, you sometimes forget that they're caring for an elephant because they treat him like a human, like a son. They warm his milk, they bathe him, they kick a soccer ball around with him, and they cuddle with him. It's really a touching portrait of an unconventional family and an example of the way humans and animals can thrive together instead of just coexisting. Their story is the subject of the Netflix film, The Elephant Whisperers. It's the first film by director Kartiki Gonsalves, and it's nominated for Best Documentary Short Film at this year's Oscars. And Kartiki joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, so how did this couple end up caring for this baby elephant, Raghu?
Raghu's mother had wandered into a nearby village in search of food and water. And this was during a long, prolonged drought. So basically, she got electrocuted and died instantly as they were searching for food. So then Raghu basically was hanging around her body for a little while. And then he went and joined a herd of cows. And then after that, he realized he couldn't get enough to eat. And that's when he ventured towards the nearby village and he started stealing fruits and vegetables from the local shops. And he got attacked by stray dogs. And that's why he does not have a tail. And then the local people intervened and looked after him for a little bit. And then they realized they couldn't care for a baby elephant. And they called the forest department to come and help. And that's when Bhuman arrived on the scene to look after Raghu, nurse him back to health, and then later on actually take him back to the camp.
And Bhuman works for the forest department?
Yes, he does. He does. The forest department has employed a lot of the indigenous people because of their ancient knowledge of the forest and land.
And it's to take care of these elephants that have been separated from the herd and need tending.
Yes. Bowman has always been with elephants. I mean, his grandfather looked after elephants. His father looked after elephants. And Bowman, in fact, got his job the day his father died. So it's something that's very ancestral in this region.
All right. So let me play another clip from the movie. And here's Bowman talking about that, how caring for these elephants is like serving God for him.
Seeing an elephant to us is equivalent to seeing God. God and elephants are one for me. The way I serve God is the same way I serve the elephants. We take care of Raghu every single day, which in turn puts food on my table every day. This is God's presence in my life. Without him, we'd have nothing.
What is the significance of the elephant in Hindu faith? Because one of the most important gods, as I understand it, Ganesha, has at the head of an elephant.
Yes. Elephants are sacred symbols of peace, mental strength, and power. And over 80% of Indians are Hindus and members of the Hindu religion. The elephant is an extremely sacred animal. And it's a living reincarnation of one of their most important gods, Ganesha, an elephant-headed deity who rides upon a tiny mouse. Lord Ganesha is said to be a remover of obstacles and a power and a provider of fortune and good luck. And it's sad today, but there are roughly around 35 to 40,000 Asian elephants left. And the situation is extremely grim because we're losing elephants at alarming rates due to poaching and human elephant conflict. And it's really interesting because Bowman, apart from an elephant caregiver, is also a Hindu temple priest. He worships Ganesha in temples and looks after elephants in real life. And that's what's really special about this.
So how does he take care of Raghu? What is his daily life like? What is it like to take care of an elephant?
Yeah, so you have a woman. He wakes up in the morning. He immediately wakes up early in the morning, goes and opens Raghu's shed, and he takes him out. And they have a very sweet moment together every single morning. And then he leads him down to the river where he has a bath. He loves splashing around in the water. And Raghu is one of the elephants I've seen. He absolutely just loves being outside and being in the water. And they have their moments in the morning. There's a lot of hanging with each other and cuddling. And then they head back and they get breakfast. So that's when he gets his first meal, which includes a rice ball, a ragi, which is a type of millet, and a piece of coconut, and also a big piece of jaggery, which is the palm sugar, and an entire stick of sugarcane. So that is what their meal is composed of. He loves his sweets. Raghu sometimes is very moody when he eats. He only likes the rice balls sometimes, and sometimes he only likes the ragi balls. And most of the time, he wants his dessert first. So he loves to have his way up. In
like
the beginning.
Every young kid prefers dessert to the main meal.
And then after that, all the monkeys come and feed on his leftovers because there's always leftovers, and not just with him, with the other elephants as well. So they have an entire meal. It's like not just feeding the elephants, but also feeding all the animals that live with Raghu. And after that, he gets to go into the forest, and he basically leads the life of a wild elephant. He grazes in the wilderness the entire day until it's about evening, where he goes for another bath in the river. And then he comes back and has a second meal, and then he retires for the night. And Raghu and Bowman and Valley, have a whole lot going on for themselves because they let him graze, but they have to go cut grass, cut fresh bamboo. They've got to make sure he has water all the time, clean his pen out, cook for themselves. So their day is really, really busy. But for Raghu, he just relaxes in the wilderness.
Sounds like a great life. So, but also they have an emotional intelligence, elephants, as you illustrate in the movie. And Belly, at one point we learned that she was previously married to a man who was killed by a tiger. She also lost her daughter, so she's had a lot of tragedy. And here's another clip from the film where Belly is talking about how Raghu comforted her.
When I cried, Raghu wiped my tears with his trunk. And the small gesture comforted me. I feel he really understands everything. I remember what my daughter was like at Raghu's age. Taking care of Raghu reminds me of my daughter.
Now, we want to be careful not to anthropomorphize too much with these animals, but how are they able to understand human emotions?
I think I would put that in this sense. I think that it's more a fact that we really need to respect other animals. The elephant is very intelligent and emotional and a social being. So it was a really good place to start because I think humans can relate to elephants because elephants share many human traits. And coming back to this documentary in specific, I'm just hoping people are able to relate to Raghu. And since they share so many traits, I think it was really great for people to be able to see for themselves that Raghu was emitting all these independent emotions. And I think there's a documentary which really allows minimal interpretation. We basically went into the field and started documenting these beautiful moments between each other. And it's exactly as you said, we didn't want to anthropomorphize the whole thing because we don't want to project our human emotions onto animals.
Yeah. So your film does touch on these issues that we discussed briefly earlier about how the habitat is shrinking, the elephants are in danger. As you say, there are only 35 to 40,000 of them left. There's climate change, drought, deforestation, all of that stuff that is threatening these elephants. And you don't talk a lot about that in the movie. You mainly focus on the story of Raghu and his caretakers. So I guess I'm wondering why you didn't focus more on these bigger issues.
While most films have focused more on humans being cured by a bond with an animal or wild animals suffering from human expansion into their territory, I really think that The Elephant Whisperers lets viewers understand both the elephants and the human carers with minimal outside interpretation. It portrays the dignity of both the magnificent elephants and the indigenous people who have lived with them and cared for them for centuries. And I wanted to get the audience to stop seeing animals as the other and to start seeing them as one of us. I think indigenous people have such an in-depth ancient knowledge and respect for the land that they live on and share their space with. And there's so much that we can learn from them. And I just wanted The Elephant Whisperers to offer a beam of hope, of mutual respect and cooperation, and a way forward through coexistence. And I've really strongly felt that the best way to be able to protect something and is to understand it and love it.
So does Raghu, will he spend his whole life living in this preserve?
Yes. Yes. This will be the rest of Raghu's life. He's already grown really big at this stage. He's taller than me. When I first met him, he was about 3 feet tall and now he's about 6.5. So he will be living in that camp because rewilding him basically back to the wild is not an option. He's been raised by Burman and Belly from a very young age and he's been under the care of humans. So letting him go back in the wild would just be really dangerous for him as an elephant. He would not be able to fend for himself or learn how to be amongst wild animals. And these are certain things that are taught to him by his wild herd. And that's, we actually have put that into the movie where Burman and Belly literally say that there's only so much that we can do for him, that things that we cannot do for Raghu, that only his wild herd can. And these are some of the things, the migrating paths, the search for water, and the other elephants that he can mingle with in the wild. And all of these are things that he requires. And also being amongst tigers, learning how to deal with them. All of that are things that he would have learned how to do in the wild with the wild herd.
Which he'll never learn?
And he won't be able to learn that because he's been raised by humans and he's been amongst humans and he gets to interact with a few wild elephants which come by the camp and so on. But that's about it.
Are they dangerous, elephants? I guess they you can be trampled as a human by an elephant or gored by their tusks. But are they ever aggressive toward humans?
Of course, yes. Elephants are just really very large beings. And just due to their sheer size, they become dangerous. And there's a whole lot of human-animal conflict in the space that I live in across India because we have elephants walking down the main roads. We have elephants coming into people's yards. And it's just a different way of coexistence on a whole different level because here you have people and indigenous communities living on the periphery of the forest and interacting with elephants on a day-to-day basis. In fact, the Forest Department is actually working with the indigenous communities and helping them build these 10-foot trenches so that elephants can't cross into their village land, because you have farmers who have cultivated lots of crops over big spans of area and they have their crops planned out for the entire year. So it's really a lot when a whole elephant herd walks into a farmer's land and destroys all the crops, because that would have been that farmer's way of living and the way he feeds his family for the next year. So this becomes a big question about how indigenous people and people living with elephants can move ahead into the future, and that it comes only through coexistence. And there's this beautiful example. There are many villages in where this documentary was filmed where the trenches have come in. The people are happy because the elephants can't cross the trenches and their crops are saved, and they also love elephants. So it's a beautiful way to see coexistence working in a wonderful way. But there are places where this has not been done yet, and it's not possible in all locations. It's something that will evolve over time. They keep finding new strategies to help everyone thrive.
Well, congratulations on the nomination and on the movie. It's really beautiful to watch this unfold and be a part of this world.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's Kartiki Gonzalez. Her film, The Elephant Whisperers, is nominated for Best Documentary Short Film at this year's Academy Awards. Coming up, this year's Latin Grammy Awards will take place in Spain. A lot of people are angry about that. We'll tell you why next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The Latin Grammy is para
Bad Bunny.
Reggaeton artist Bad Bunny back in 2019, winning a Latin Grammy Award. For more than two decades, the Latin Grammys have celebrated music in Spanish and Portuguese, and the show is usually held in Las Vegas. Late last month, the Latin Recording Academy quietly announced the next ceremony will take place in Spain. That's the first time it'll be held outside the United States. The move to Spain has some fans and some critics because, well, Spain is not in Latin America. And the epicenter of Latin music's explosion in popularity is, well, Latin America. Joining us to talk about this is Susie Exposito, columnist at the LA Times. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. How's it going?
Great. Okay, why? Why are the Grammys moving, the Latin Grammys moving to Spain?
The Latin Recording Academy, turns out, had been in talks with the Minister of Tourism in Andalusia. And the Andalusian government, you know, they put forth a pretty good deal. They promised to contribute 18 million euros, which is like $19 million, in total between the years of 2023 and 2025 towards the cost of producing the Latin Grammys and a series of events around it. So far, we only know that this year's Latin Grammys are taking place in Spain, specifically in Andalusia. We don't know what city yet. It seems that they're leaning towards Sevilla, but it hasn't been decided. Mm-hmm. As for, you know, future Latin Grammys, we don't know that yet, but they want to have a recurring series of events around the awards.
So what is your reaction to that? Do you think it's a good idea?
I'm surprised, really. This is unprecedented. This ceremony has always taken place in the U.S., mostly in Las Vegas. It's been so beneficial for acts, you know, in like acts from all over the Hispanic and Portuguese speaking worlds to come to the U.S. and tour. You know, it's been a great incentive for them to finally come to see U.S. audiences and make some money and get some recognition. So this is kind of an unusual one, but I guess if the Latin Grammys were able to find an outside sponsor, then that's I believe that's probably like a huge part of it.
Also, is Rosalia a huge part of it? Because she is Spanish and her album won Album of the Year last year. And before we get into this, let's just hear a cut from that. Here's a bit of her song, Candy. No más olvido, no más olvido, no más olvido.
Quiero como antes, me rompiste pero solo en parte, quedaba tu clave para pensarte, pero de olvidarte yo ya hice un arte. Na, 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 no queda, na, 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 na.
All right, that's Rosalia singing from her song Candy. Pick it up from there. Do you think that that had something to do with locating the next award show in Spain, the fact that she is Spanish and a huge, huge star?
You know, she is one of Spain's biggest exports right now. Mm-hmm. You know, she is the country's most popular artist. She's a globally popular artist, you know, but right. I think that actually the Spanish government has a huge incentive to host the Latin Grammys because the country has invested a ton of money in music tourism and in exporting music as much as they have bringing it in to the country. You know, like Spain struggled for years to retain its young people and to keep them employed. You know, in 2021, Spain reported a youth unemployment rate of 36.9%.
Ooh, wow.
Yes. So like in the interest of trying to, you know, keep unemployment down, the country has invested a lot of money in music tourism. Before the pandemic, Spain was host to almost 900 music festivals annually. And bringing the Latin Grammys to Spain, the Andalusian government has actually projected a revenue of 500 million euros, which translates to $530 million over the course of like the years 2023 and 2025. So
so money was the bigger lure is what you're saying.
I think money speaks very yeah. loudly, but I think also, you know, Rosalia has garnered fans, you know, not just in Spain, not just in Latin America, you know, I mean, she's got a lot of fans who don't even speak Spanish. So I think it's interesting. You know, she's a darling at the Latin Grammys. But, you know, I think it also has a lot to do with the voting body of the Academy, just like the English language gringo Grammys, as some of us call them. Mm-hmm. We've seen who gets to be, you know, like welcomed into the Academy, who gets like the red carpet rolled out for them. And I think that it's largely a matter of who gets to vote. The same people who voted for Spanish artists like Enrique Iglesias or Alejandro Sanz 20 years ago, they're still voting today. And I think a lot of people still don't get the distinction that Hispanic is used to describe a shared language, that being Spanish. And the word Latino is used to describe the very broad ethnic group of people from or descended from Latin America. So we see, you know, whether it's the Latin Grammys or the Anglophone Grammys, we see like a blurring between these two groups. Mm-hmm. And I feel like someone like Rosalia has benefited from that. However, in Spain, people seem to get the difference right away. I mean, if you're like coming from Mexico or the Caribbean, especially, they'll be really quick to clock your accent and even try to correct you. So,
yeah, that you don't have the th sound on your S's.
Exactly. We don't do the list.
Yeah.
So,
well, in all seriousness, are people angry that the Latin Grammys will be in Spain for that reason?
Some people are, yeah. You know, like, I think it's important to stress that the Latin Grammys, and I feel like they they have to explain it every year, but like to qualify for a Latin Grammy, you don't have to be from Latin America. You know, for your work to be nominated, all that's required is that your entry contains at least 51% of lyrics in Spanish or Portuguese or accepted languages or dialects. And it must be a new song. So those are the only requirements, which allows, you know, all kinds of people to be nominated, whether it's Rosalía or even someone like Laura Pausini, who's from Italy and made a huge career out of singing in Spanish.
Búscate un amigo que sea refugio bajo la tormenta.
But they're not as angry to the point where they would boycott or launch a boycott campaign or do anything like that, right? Yet? I don't know. The ceremony takes place in the fall, so who knows?
Yeah, it takes place in November. I mean, people have a lot of time. And listen, it wouldn't be the first time that people boycotted the Latin Grammys. I remember there were a few reggaeton artists a couple years ago who sat out of the Latin Grammys, you know, because reggaeton was not acknowledged in the general categories. You know, it got snubbed for years. And so you had artists, you know, like J Balvin was one of the loudest proponents of the boycott, because he was just like, yeah, without reggaeton, there's no Latin Grammys. Reggaeton is like the biggest sound. It's been the most commercially popular sound, not just in Latin America, but you hear all kinds of people making reggaeton. And, you know, for some people, it's like, you know, strictly commercial. You know, they want to cash in on that commercial success. And then other people, you know, I think artists like Rosalía and some other Spanish artists like of her generation, when they embrace styles like reggaeton or bachata or dembow, I think they believe that embracing those sounds is like progressive, being that there are Latino communities in Spain. There are like immigrant communities from all over Latin America living in Spain. And a lot of them, you know, continue to experience discrimination. A lot of them are maligned and abused. And so for, you know, Spaniards to embrace those sounds, it feels, at least to them, it feels like a step forward, where they're embracing these art forms because they believe they're embracing a much maligned diaspora. However, these intentions don't quite land the same way in the Western Hemisphere because of the legacy of colonialism and a lot of the critical thinking around what continues to tie Latinos to Spain.
Interesting. But maybe this opens the door for the Latin Grammys to be held in San Juan next time.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing? It could have happened. I mean, you know, San Juan would have made a great candidate for the Latin Grammys. Mexico City has like the space, the infrastructure. Like there are so many Latin American cities that would have been fabulous for the Latin Grammys, but the ceremony is not like the Olympics. It's not the kind of thing that every city applies to do. I think this was a deal that took years to negotiate and one that came with state sponsorship, you know? So I think that's really key in talking about why the Latin Grammys are being held in Spain.
Will you go if you get a chance?
Oh, totally. You know, I've always wanted to see Andalusia just as like a music buff. You know, I grew up like my Cuban father would play me a lot of flamenco music when I was growing up. And I've always wanted to see the birthplace of flamenco and experience it for myself, you know. So as a reporter and as a journalist, it's my job to be curious and ask questions and just see what's up. So I would totally love to go and see what's up.
All right. Well, let's hope you get a chance to do that. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Susie Exposito, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. And that will do it for today on Press Play. A happy Monday to all of you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.